Nietzsche's emphasis on truthfulness and his dedication to science, or Wissenschaft, would suggest that at the very heart of his endeavor, as the heart of every scientific or philosophical endeavor, is the pursuit of the truth. But this has to be sort of weighed against Nietzsche's frequent statements, which often go, there is no truth, there are only interpretations, or there is no truth, only appearances, or there is no truth, only the prejudices of mankind, or there is no truth, only our indispensable errors. On the one hand, it's very clear that Nietzsche prides himself above all as being a truthful philosopher, as talking the world, expressing the world as he sees it. At the same time, he says there is no truth. It's a paradox that runs through Nietzsche's work, and it's one, I think, that needs to be resolved. I should say that it's clearly not the centerpiece of Nietzsche's philosophy, although it recurs in many different works, and I think too many commentators recently have taken this as being the most important thing that Nietzsche had to say. In particular, some of the postmodernists, in France especially, have taken Nietzsche's view that there is no truth and his emphasis on rhetoric to say that Nietzsche, in fact, doesn't make any assertions that philosophy itself should be reduced to literature, that, in fact, philosophy really doesn't have much to say. Even science is just another kind of literary discourse. Nietzsche, I think, would have rejected such views utterly out of hand. He would have considered them nonsense, and worse, he would have considered them absolutely antithetical to being everything that someone who's interested in Wissenschaft should be. Nevertheless, let's talk about this paradox, this apparent contradiction, because then I think we're going to get a lot clearer about some of the things that Nietzsche says of a much more polemical and practical nature later on. First of all, as always, there's a kind of ad hominem argument. I ended the last lecture by suggesting one version of it, and this is a sense in which Nietzsche turns against science, in which he asks why science, or more specifically, why scholars in general, scholarly oxen, as he calls them at one point, are so devoted to the truth. The question is, why is truth important? This seems like a nonsense question for someone who's already devoted to the truth, but of course, if you're devoted to the truth, one of the questions that has to come up is the question, why are we interested in truth? And Nietzsche asks at one point, very polemically, why must we have truth at any cost? And of course, if you think, it's often come at a great cost. Individual lives have been ruined. Giant scientists back in the 16th, 17th century were burned at the stake for their beliefs, or they lost their status, or they were excommunicated. People have often been in a position of virtually upsetting an entire civilization with their ideas. Freud comes to mind as an obvious example. So there's a sense in which the costs of truth are tremendous. And what Nietzsche wants to ask is, why are we willing to pay them? As always, it's a question about motivation. And to sort of set up the general scheme of the entire lecture, it's going to be that the search for truth can't be viewed as an isolated phenomenon, but rather, the search for truth is, like everything else, part of life and has to be understood on more general principles that have to do with how we live our life in general. Some obvious examples. Sometimes the search for truth is really the search for a certain kind of status. The philosopher who comes up with the right theory, the scientist who comes up with the best hypothesis, they have a certain kind of status in their profession. So, one can say, why are they after the truth? Well, it may be that they are interested in the problem, but first and foremost, they are motivated by the need to have status. Watson, in his description of his work with Crick on the analysis of DNA, is quite straightforward about the fact that what moved them was, more than anything else, their competition with their fellow scientists to discover the structure first. Another explanation is that truth, in fact, is not an end in itself. not something pursued for its own sake, but truth is something which is pursued for other goals. Most notable example is the well-known phrase, "The truth shall make you free." That fact is inscribed on one of the Texas University buildings. It's something that we often pass as philosophers with a mixture of pride and curiosity. But the idea that the truth will make you free, of course, is to say precisely that truth itself is not the end. Truth is a means. Truth leads to freedom. Also, the idea of truth lends itself to a kind of sense of the absolute. If you've got the truth, and you get this picture of the truth as rock hard and immovable, and of course, since ancient times, often the truth, reality, is also eternal. From that standpoint, you're in a powerful position. And of course, as so often in Nietzsche, the search for truth is going to get analyzed in terms of the search for power. Looking for truth is itself an honorable, praiseworthy, high-status enterprise. And as well, having the truth, or claiming to have the truth, puts you in a privileged position. Why are people so adamant about the truth? They're adamant about the truth because it makes them, in some way, important. Nevertheless, Nietzsche's arguments about truth, insofar as he does give us arguments, suggest something else as well. Take, for example, the idea that there is no truth. There are only interpretations. Well, one way to think about that is that there's no way of getting to the bottom of things. Take, for example, a text. A text, and let's take the obvious, most important example for many of us, the Bible. You take a text, and you have to right away admit the obvious. Former governor of Texas said something like, in an argument about bilingual education, "If English was good enough for Jesus, it's good enough for us." But of course, it's not hard to realize that the Bible that we read is a translation. More accurately, it's a translation of a translation of a translation of a translation. And as everyone knows who's ever translated anything, there are all sorts of questions of interpretation that enter in at each step. It's not just presenting the original text, but it's already presenting the original text transformed, and one might argue, distorted. And in the case of the Bible, of course we know, it's not just a matter of having an original text, because it's a text which was cobbled together from many different texts, and those different texts themselves were interpretations of events, interpretations of myths and stories, interpretations for which there could be no original evidence in many cases. And so what we're talking about, if we're talking about the Bible as a text, is not really a text at all, but rather it is a series of interpretations, one on top of the other, going back to a set of facts which are themselves indeterminable. So to say that there is no truth, there are only interpretations, is to say that everything, not just texts, but our own experience, is an interpretation based on other interpretations based on other interpretations. For example, take any common experience. The experience, for example, of wearing a wristwatch. Well, why do I think it's a wristwatch? Well, because I've been brought up in this culture, and I've been taught that that's what this thing is, and I know quite a bit about what it does, if not anything about how it does it. What's more, the whole notion of a wristwatch is built not just into the culture, but there's a sense in which it requires the use of language. I can imagine someone from a very different kind of culture looking at it and thinking of it as nothing but a bracelet, an ornament of some sort, or perhaps as a rather grotesque aberration of my skin on my wrist. There's a sense in which to understand anything is to interpret it. And if you want to work your way back to the original facts on which it's based, Nietzsche will tell us there are no such facts. There is no original text. That it's all experience, and experience is always an interpretation of something else. There's a sense in which, when Nietzsche talks about there being no appearances, when Nietzsche talks about there being no truth, only appearances. That, too, presents us with a kind of paradox. For example, there's a sense in which to talk about appearances is automatically to talk about the appearance of something. If I see an appearance of Kathy, the presumption is that Kathy's there. Or if not, the appearance resembles Kathy. Perhaps I'm hallucinating, but it refers to Kathy. There's got to be a Kathy for there to be an appearance of Kathy. Well, there's a sense in which appearances then are dependent. Appearances depend on there being something of which there are appearances. But now we ask the question, how do you ever get behind the appearances? And this, of course, is an old philosophical question. It's perhaps most famous in modern philosophy through someone like Descartes, who asked this kind of skeptical question, how do I know that my experiences aren't fooling me? Or the kind of Humean skepticism in a much more radical way, how do I know my experiences refer to anything at all? Of course, it goes back to the early Greeks because they were skeptics too, and they asked questions of a similar sort. You find them even in Plato. But the idea here is that in talking about appearances, in talking about the world as it is in itself, what we always end up talking about is a gap between the experience, the appearances, on the one hand, and what they are appearances or experiences of on the other. Kant perhaps makes it most explicit when he talks about the world of our experience as distinguished from the world in itself, the world as it might be apart from our experiences. But there's always this problem, which every philosopher has had to face. How can you even assert such a thing if there's no way of getting behind the experience, going behind the appearances, and seeing reality itself? Some philosophers have included from this that it's nonsense to talk about this at all. Other philosophers have tried many different tricks of logic, of science, to try and show how we can defend what we believe, what we experience, on the basis of some sort of proof, on the basis of some sort of inference. But however you do this, you're always left with a deep puzzle. How can you even talk about experiences as opposed to reality if you can never compare the experiences and reality to see if they match up? Nietzsche struggles with this question virtually all of his career. And I think the way to understand many of his more enigmatic statements about truth, such things as there is no truth, is to understand that all the stages in this grappling with this basic paradox. And Nietzsche's ultimate resolution is to see his way through the paradox, and as he puts it in one of his more striking aphorisms, actually a six-part aphorism, he says in the conclusion, "Let's get rid of the real world, and with the real world, the apparent world disappears too." In other words, to take Kant and Hegel at, in one sense, their most generous, one might say that what they discovered and what Nietzsche is now discovering for himself is that the very distinctions that philosophers have made since ancient times, since Parmenides, between reality on the one hand and appearance on the other, is a bogus distinction. There is only the world of our experience. To talk about anything else just doesn't make any sense. But now, what do we say about the world of our experience? Does it consist of facts? Does it consist of truths? And let's be very clear that what Nietzsche is doing is emphatically not denying that some claims are more warranted than others, that we can't say anything truthful about ourselves or about the world. That is just plain wrong, because Nietzsche is, among all philosophers, together with Socrates, one of the ones who is most adamant about seeing, in some sense, the truth. But the truth has to be understood in terms of interpretations, in terms of experiences. So let's address the entire question from a different angle. There's a sense that comes out clearly in Kant of the world in itself, the world as God might perceive it. And Kant himself says, this is, for us, a notion bordering on nonsense, because the truth is we have no conception whatsoever. We can't have a conception of what such a world in itself might be. For Nietzsche, there is no such world in itself. But more importantly, there is no God's eye view. No way, not just because there is no God, but because even if there were a God, as I said in a very early lecture, even if there were a God, he would still have to see the world from a perspective, even though it's a God's perspective. The truth is, we always see the world from a perspective. And I indicated in the last lecture that, for example, we can look at the world, a flower growing on a table, from a scientific perspective, or we can look at it from an aesthetic perspective. We can look at certain questions. For example, the miracles described in the Old and New Testaments. We can look at those as religious truths, or we can look at them as scientific questions. How could this have happened? How can this be explained? We can, in our lives, take a view of ourselves as a parent, ourselves as a teacher, ourselves as still a child, ourselves as citizens, ourselves as citizens of the world. And with each shift in perspectives, what we're doing is, in a way, changing the truths. That's not to say that there is no truth, but now what we've started to do is we've started to relativize truth. And I want to be very careful here not to relativize it in a vicious way, but simply to say at this point, that what we're doing is appreciating that what might be a truth from one point of view, say a religious point of view, might not be a truth from, say, a scientific point of view. The debate between creationists and evolutionists, for example. I think one way of resolving that dispute, which even the Pope himself has accepted, is that there's a religious point of view of the matter, and there's a scientific point of view of the matter, and the one doesn't exclude the other. They're simply different perspectives, different ways of accounting for and appreciating the same set of phenomena. This idea in Nietzsche, which especially in his experimental period when he's writing Human Alto Human, Daybreak, Gay Science, is conceived of in terms of a view that is now called perspectivism. Nietzsche didn't label his views for the most part, but this one is pretty close to what he himself regarded. Perspectivism is the view that there are lots of different viewpoints we can take on things. And what's more, it's not as if, as the word perspective, which is a visual metaphor, would suggest, that there is something of which these are different perspectives. One might say, rather unhelpfully, it's life, or it's the world of experience. But ultimately, what you want to say is simply, this is the perspective, this is the context, this is the truth that emerges from that perspective. And of course, from within a perspective, one can argue quite vigorously about what evidence there is, about what follows from the evidence, about what hypothesis is more plausible than another hypothesis, or moving from science to aesthetics, what is more beautiful, or a most beautiful way of looking at something than something else. So it's not as if perspectivism rules out the question of argument, debate, or the search for truth. But rather, it says, this is always to be conceived of as contextualized. Now, perspectivism itself is a fascinating theory. In fact, perhaps the most exciting example of it, which we're going to talk about at great length in several coming lectures, is the possibility of different moral perspectives. And, of course, this goes back to what I began this lecture with, the idea that there's always a motive for seeking the truth. The idea of different moral perspectives might again be used to raise the question, why do scientists and philosophers, scholars, devote themselves to the search for truth, often eliminating many of the other happinesses of normal human life, social life, family? And the answer, in part, might be because of personal status, the search for freedom, the need for power. But Nietzsche is perfectly willing to allow that there's something like a little automatic mechanism that gets scholars, scientists going, looking for the truth. Nevertheless, this is something that has to be explained in terms of their personalities, in terms of the context, in terms of the kind of encouragement they get from their culture. In general, science is a definitive perspective, but so are many other things. And in morality in particular, we're going to see two very different perspectives. In fact, there would be many more. But the two very different perspectives are the ones that Nietzsche calls master and slave morality. These are not just simply two different cultural artifacts. They are not simply two different ways of looking at morality, but they're two very different perspectives on the world. And here in particular, something very important comes through. That talking about different perspectives is not to say that any perspective is on a par or just as good as any other perspective. And Nietzsche is going to be very cautious here. On the one hand, he wants to be clear that, look, people do hold the one perspective and they hold the other perspective, and that's their perspective. But at the same time, there is no question reading Nietzsche on morality that he considers the masterly perspective the better one, and for lots of reasons which we'll go into in some detail. In general, this notion of perspectivism, as I suggested in the second lecture, has to be distinguished, at least from a vicious sense, of relativism. Relativism that says every view is as good as any other. Not true. But I think it can be allied to relativism in what I call the innocent and almost obvious sense. And that is that different truths, different hypotheses, different suggestions of all different sorts are necessarily in a context, and that means in a perspective. Now, what does a philosopher do? What a philosopher should do is essentially adopt as many perspectives as possible. And this, I think, is the philosophical explanation behind many of Nietzsche's stylistic devices, particularly the device of the aphorism. As Kathy indicated in her discussion, there are many different perspectives one can take on a given aphorism, and also within a book, often within the same section. Nietzsche will give a number of aphorisms on more or less the same topic, sometimes taking seemingly opposed points of view, which has led many philosophers to accuse him of inconsistency, or Karl Jaspers, who is one of Nietzsche's early admirers, saying that Nietzsche never find any claim without looking for its contradiction. That's a bit excessive, but I think there's a very important point that lies behind it, and that is, with Nietzsche, it is always a matter of not simply taking one position and digging in. I mean, philosophers make their whole career taking a position, digging it in, protecting it against all comers. But philosophy is shifting positions. I often say to my students as a very important exercise, particularly for those who are particularly dogmatic about one position or another, I want them to write me a short paper in which they take the opposed position. If they are Christian fundamentalists, I want them to write a paper against Christian fundamentalism. If they're atheists, I want them to write a paper in defense of theism. In general, I think it's very important to keep shifting perspectives. And according to Nietzsche, what the philosopher is supposed to do as part of his experimentalism is to keep shifting views so that you appreciate how these different views, first of all, operate in their own terms, but then, of course, more generally, understanding how these different perspectives operate together. Where is the truth? Well, I talked about the truth within a perspective, particularly, of course, if we're talking about a scientific perspective, but there's also a larger truth, what Hegel, for example, called philosophical truth. It's not something that lies behind the appearances. It's not something that only God can know. But rather, philosophical truth is getting this sense, this very large and ever-increasing sense of how these different perspectives, how these different ways of looking at things all tie together. Now, that's not the end of the story. One part of the story, of course, is to talk about multiple perspectives, or to talk about what William James refers to as pluralism, is to allow for the problematic possibility for many people that you must entertain or be able to entertain different viewpoints and different truths, perhaps at the same time. Emerson famously said that consistency is the hobgoblin of little minds. Nietzsche, of course, admired Emerson quite greatly, and I can imagine that this is one way of characterizing Nietzsche's philosophy too. Now, by inconsistency, he doesn't mean the sort of flat logical contradiction that philosophers are appalled by, but rather, he's talking about different perspectives. Why can't you be a scientist, an evolutionist, and a creationist at the same time? Why can't you be a chemist who understands the chemistry of oil paint and at the same time appreciate the beauty of a particular painting? There's no reason, but philosophical sophistication and the philosophical skill that we should be cultivating in ourselves is precisely this ability to hold these different perspectives in mind at the same time. But something more. Nietzsche, as we've suggested several times now, is a quasi-follower of Darwin. And Nietzsche, being Nietzsche, often emphasizes his disagreements more than he underscores his agreements. But his agreements with Darwin, in fact, are multiple and profound. One, of course, is that Darwin says, in effect, that we're animals, and we should be understood in terms of the general trend of evolution. Nietzsche thoroughly agrees with this. But he agrees with Darwin in another sense, too. And although he doesn't talk much about natural selection, in fact, he has some arguments against it, one can see Nietzsche's view of truth very much in terms of something like Darwinian notions of fitness. Today, this would be called by some philosophers a pragmatic theory of truth. The name comes from James and Dewey. But I think it really fits Nietzsche as well, and has, as it does explicitly in James and Dewey, Darwinian roots. I want you to imagine how it comes about that people have certain kinds of beliefs. And here, let's not talk about very particular beliefs, like coconuts grow on palm trees. But let's talk about very general beliefs. In fact, beliefs that are so general that they have been talked about by many modern philosophers as the presuppositions or the foundations of all knowledge. David Hume, for example, talks, for one, about the importance of induction and the idea that the future will resemble the past. And that's how we learn. He is a devout empiricist. We learn on the basis of experience. And we learn not just particular things, but we also learn, in some sense, the most basic things. And Hume's skepticism is very much contained, is very much caught up in the question, how do you defend these most basic principles? How do you defend the idea of induction? Kant comes along and answers Hume's question. Kant comes along and says, basically, induction really amounts to one of the rules according to which the human mind operates. If something happens, then it is more likely to happen again. In general, the future will be like the past. It is built right into our minds. Well, Nietzsche is not going to stop it there. As always, Nietzsche wants to push the question. How did that belief get there? Why is it built into the human mind? And a Darwinian answer makes perfectly good sense. Suppose you imagine a species of creatures who have built into their brains the idea that the future will be unlike the past, so that if you see lightning strike a tall tree, you rush under the tree during the next storm, expecting that lightning will never strike twice in the same place, or having struck a tall tree this time, lightning will strike somewhere else next time. The odds are that such a species would be short-lived. On the other hand, a species that developed an inductive mind, that learned from experience, is much more likely to survive and flourish. So when Nietzsche says, what are our truths? In fact, taking up from Kant even our synthetic a priori truths, those basic foundational truths. He says, they are the indispensable errors of mankind. They are the truths without which we would not as a species survive. But if what you're asking is, does this correspond to some real world apart from experience? The answer is, that's a nonsensical question.